All right, so this is Bio 241, and it's November 12th. Amazing. Already, and that means that we have a test 1 week from today. No, too soon. I know it's too soon. I say that a lot. But it's going to cover, what's it going to cover? It's going to cover the sensory chapter, endocrinology, and muscle. Okay, so, and that's what we're going to start doing today, and we'll finish up on Monday, and then take a test on that on Wednesday. And we need to get that test in before the drop deadline. I don't know if anybody's considering dropping the class or not, but at least I want to get this fourth test in to the calculation for your grades, because the drop date was published. I have it in the syllabus here. The 19th, but that's not correct. Okay, the 19th is the date that was in the schedule of classes, but on the printout that I got from the class roster, it says the 22nd. So the 22nd is the actual drop date for pretty much all classes, if they're 18-week classes on campus. All right, so does anybody have any questions over the endocrinology chapter? You all know what an endocrine gland is. You know what a hormone is. Okay. What's the target tissue? What's the target tissue? Uh-oh. Good thing I asked. What is a target tissue? It's got to have something. What does a target tissue have? Yeah, a receptor. A target tissue is just a receptor to a particular hormone. So that hormone can have an effect in that particular tissue because it's got to have a receptor. All right. Well, we ended up last time talking about parathyroid hormone. And parathyroid hormone is important for regulating blood calcium. What are the effects of parathyroid hormone? What's the effect on bone? Parathyroid hormone, oh guys, don't cram the last minute. Parathyroid hormone, it increases blood calcium by doing what? By demineralizing bone, right? So you sacrifice bone to bring blood calcium up, but also to help absorption of calcium from the urine, so that you reabsorb calcium from the filtrate as urine is being produced, so you don't excrete any calcium. That's the effect of parathyroid hormone on the kidneys and on bone, and that raises blood calcium. All right, islands of Langerhans. We're talking about the pancreas and, in particular, regulation of blood glucose levels. There are two hormones, and you're familiar with them from lab. They're insulin and glucagon. They're going to have an effect on blood glucose levels. One increases and one decreases. Which one decreases blood glucose levels? Insulin. And which one increases blood glucose levels? Glucagon, right. And so they come from the islets of Langerhans, which are special parts of the pancreas. All right, so you see the pancreas here, just a little bit inferior to the stomach and a little bit posterior to it. You don't see the stomach. Here's the tail of the pancreas, the head of the pancreas. Here's the pancreatic duct. But aha, I thought an endocrine gland didn't have ducts. Why does this pancreas have ducts if it's an endocrine gland? Because the pancreas is part endocrine gland and part exocrine gland. It has a number of different functions. The endocrine part is carried out by the islets right here, and I don't see any ducts. But the other part of the pancreas makes digestive enzymes that get secreted into the pancreatic duct, which then flows into the duodenum. So the digestive enzyme synthesizing and secretion part is part of the exocrine function of the pancreas, and different than the endocrine part of the pancreas. All right, so hopefully you can follow what I'm saying when I'm using those terms. If not, you got to ask me. All right, so there are two different kinds of cells in an islet inside the pancreas. There are alpha and beta cells, and the alpha cells secrete glucagon, and the beta cells secrete insulin. So there are glucose receptors in these cells that can be stimulated by glucose concentration in the blood. All right, so alphas secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose, and glucagon stimulates glycogenolysis and lipolysis. So what is this glycogenolysis pathway? Glycogen is converted to glucose. It's broken down, right? And then that glucose in the liver is secreted into the blood, right? And that increases blood glucose. And the beta cells secrete insulin in response to high blood glucose. What kind of state is somebody in when they have high, when glucose is high in their blood? Even a normal person, okay? When somebody has high glucose in their blood, we usually think of it as either being a fed state or a fasted state. It is which one? It is the fed state, right? The fed state. So when you eat something, that glucose gets absorbed by your digestive tract, goes into the blood, and elevates your blood glucose. Insulin then is released so that your cells can take it up. So it promotes entry of glucose into cells. And that's probably an exam figure. How does glucose get into cells? Can it just diffuse in simply? Simple diffusion? No. What's the process called? Facilitated diffusion. So it needs a protein carrier. Give me a name of a glucose transporter. Like a GLUT4 transporter. Where are GLUT4 transporters kept in reserve, waiting for the insulin signal? They're in the cytoplasm. What organelle holds on to them? The organelles are called an endosome. An endosome. That's one of the exam figures. Okay. Insulin then, also that can stimulate the conversion of glucose into glycogen, which is a storage form of glucose, and it can also stimulate the production of fat, taking glucose and converting it to fat. But fat can't ever go back into being glucose. So since cells take up glucose, that decreases blood glucose. So stimulus here on the illustration is increased blood glucose that's monitored by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans, which secrete insulin, that increases cellular uptake of glucose because the GLUT4 transporters are inserted into the cell membrane. And so that decreases blood glucose. So this is the response. Decreased blood glucose subtracts from the stimulus. So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism, maintaining blood glucose within a homeostatic range. Once glucose is inside the cell, it can be incorporated into glycogen in liver and skeletal muscle. And glucose can be used to make triglycerides in adipose tissue. And then the triglycerides are stored within the cell, within the adipocyte. All right, so other things you should know about diabetes mellitus is that there are two different kinds. And the two different kinds are type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is characterized by the inability of your body to produce insulin. Maybe we don't know exactly why that happened. Maybe an infection of the pancreas, viral infection of the pancreas that killed the beta cells. And so somebody can just take exogenous insulin after meals to protect themselves from the harmful effects of diabetes. And then the second type is type 2, which is due to, what about insulin? Are the levels there normal or not normal? They're normal. But what is going on there? The receptor somehow is not responding to the insulin signal. So even though insulin levels are normal, there still is not cellular uptake of glucose because of the insulin receptor. Now, what kind of receptor is that insulin receptor? Is it a ion channel? Or what? Uh-oh, you're looking at me like you haven't seen this before. It's a tyrosine kinase. So it's an enzyme receptor. When insulin binds to it, then the receptor becomes an enzyme and it phosphorylates tyrosine residues in a protein, which then causes a cascade of effects, and it inserts endosomes which carry GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane for glucose uptake. Okay, some other additional hormones. So I'm not going to spend too much time with this, but the pineal gland secretes melatonin. It helps regulate the sleep cycles, as far as we're beginning to understand. Okay, so diurnal cycles in people. So we call those circadian rhythms. So secreted at night, it's inhibited by light, and inhibits GnRH. It's an anti-gonadotrophic in many animals, so it inhibits what? Reproductive cycling. So this can explain seasonal reproductive cycles in some animals. Like, who could give me an exact? This is not human physiology, so you probably won't be tested on this. But what kind of animals have distinct reproductive cycles, seasonal reproductive cycles based on photoperiod? Okay, dogs and cats don't. But birds, for instance, sure, because birds will have young, will have clutches of eggs in the spring primarily, right? So it's the pineal gland that helps regulate that behavior. Okay, the thymus gland, located in the mediastinum, is a place where T cells, which is kind of a certain kind of white blood cell that helps fight infections, where they go to mature. So there are hormones released by the thymus gland that produces T cells, or mature T cells, to help fight infections. And when we get to the reproductive chapter, we're going to talk about some of these other kinds of hormones from the gonads. In the male, it secretes testosterone, female estrogen, and progesterone. And the placenta is an interesting tissue because that tissue is actually produced from two individuals. What two individuals' tissues come together to form the placenta? Maternal tissue and fetal tissue. So here is an organ that's actually made up of two different individuals that function as one organ in the body. And the placenta secretes estrogen, progesterone, and human chorionic gonadotropin and somatomammotropin. And we're going to talk about these hormones when we get into the reproductive chapter, so you don't have to know anything about those. And I think that's it for the endocrine system. I'm not going to cover any of these other slides. Okay? All right, so we're going to move on to the muscle chapter. So probably the most important things in the endocrine chapter are knowing something about the hypothalamus, knowing something about the different parts of the pituitary gland, how the hypothalamus controls the pituitary gland, and pituitary hormones, the effects of parathyroid hormone, and of course know something about insulin and glucagon. Okay, skeletal muscle. What is noteworthy about skeletal muscle in terms of control in your body, in terms of voluntary control? What can you tell me about skeletal muscle? That's the only thing that you have conscious control over. Everything else takes care of itself via the autonomic nervous system. All right, and what is skeletal muscle specialized to accomplish? It controls body temperature, because when skeletal muscle is working, it increases your body temperature. Yeah, because it's colder than body temperature in here right now. That means that you have to generate heat to stay at 98.6. Okay, but I don't know if it's specialized to do that necessarily. When a skeletal muscle is stimulated, what does it do? It contracts. So skeletal muscle is specialized to contract or to shorten with power, right? Okay, so here is a muscle, and a muscle all by itself. When I say muscle, you should think of an organ. All right, a muscle as being an organ. Because what is an organ in terms of tissues? What is it? It has at least two different kinds of tissues that come together to perform a certain kind of function. So what kind of tissues are in this muscle right here? And, oh, I didn't turn my arrow on. Let me turn my arrow on. All right, so this muscle right here, we could say maybe this is the coracobrachialis, or brachialis muscle, for instance. And it's an organ because it contains connective tissue, which we call fascia, It contains muscle tissue, which is a second kind of tissue. What's another kind of tissue besides connective and muscle? How about epithelium? Okay, that's another kind of tissue. What's another kind of tissue? The fourth one. Fourth and last one is nervous tissue. All right, so this muscle contains muscle. It contains connective tissue because of this fascia. It contains connective tissue because there's blood flowing through it. It contains nervous tissue because there are nerves that innervate this muscle. So it is an organ, right? Because it contains many different kinds of tissues coming together. So the connective tissue between bone and the muscle organ itself is what we call a tendon. So a tendon is a bone-to-muscle connection. When this muscle contracts, it puts tension on the tendon, and that pulls on this bone, causes the bone to move through an articulation. The connective tissue that's surrounding the whole muscle is what we call the epimysium. Okay, do you see it labeled on here anywhere? I don't see it labeled. Here, do you see skeletal muscle? Here, epimysium. Good. All right, so the connective tissue that is deep to this fascia right here is called the epimysium. That surrounds the whole muscle organ. All right, furthermore, you can see some compartments within the whole organ. These bundles right here and right here, these are what we call fascicles. Right, and fascicles are separated by perimysium. Right, so you can see perimysium. And what makes up a fascicle are individual muscle cells. So each one of these dots right here is a muscle cell. And a muscle cell is microscopically small in diameter, but it's very long in length. And you might ask, well, how did a muscle cell get to be so long? Because most cells are microscopic. Well, a muscle cell at one time was hundreds of individual precursor muscle cells that fused together to form a nice big long rod. So every skeletal muscle cell has many nuclei inside of it, depending on how many progenitor cells went into making up the adult muscle cell. So because it's long and narrow, a muscle cell is usually called a muscle fiber. All right, so a muscle fiber is different than the muscle itself. The muscle is the organ, the fiber is just the cell. And here are the nuclei inside the cell. And the connective tissue sheath surrounding every cell is what we call the endomysium. So the endomysium surrounds every cell within a fascicle. Furthermore, if we look at a cell, so here's a cell right here, we see that there are even smaller bundles inside of a cell. These you can consider as organelles performing a certain kind of function inside the cell. Give me an example of an organelle. I want to make sure you have a picture of an organelle. What's an organelle inside of a cell? Mitochondria, for instance, right? Nucleus is one. So we're looking at organelles inside the cell that are what? Also very long and narrow. These are what we call myofibrils. Okay, and notice that in every myofibril there's a repeating unit. Over and over and over again. And in neighboring myofibrils, that repeating unit is justified in that they're not interdigitated, but where you see this dark band right here, the dark bands and all the neighboring myofibrils within that cell line up perfectly. Furthermore, if we look inside the organelle, which is a myofibril, we see some even smaller kinds of rod-shaped structures. Those are what we call myofilaments. Right, and from anatomy, you probably know what we call these myofilaments. They're thick ones and thin ones. The thick ones are what we call myosin, and the thin ones are what we call actin. Okay, so this is the overall structure. So if you want to build a muscle, let's start with filaments, myofilaments. Give me a couple names. What are the two kinds of myofilaments that I just said? Actin and myosin are the two kinds, and if we put actin and myosin together and bundle them up, we get an organelle. What's that organelle called? That's a myofibril. And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, that forms a muscle fiber or a muscle cell. And then if we put a bunch of muscle cells together, we get a we get a fascicle, and if we put a bunch of fascicles together, we get a muscle, which is the organ, right? Because the organ has blood supply, nerve supply, and everything else. So that's how you would build a muscle organ or decompose it. Okay. Whenever you see this term sarco right here, that should clue you in that we're talking about skeletal muscle. Like the sarcolemma is the plasma membrane that surrounds a muscle cell. So instead of calling it plasma membrane, we call it the sarcolemma. The sarcoplasm is the same thing as the cytoplasm inside of a skeletal muscle cell. And there is also smooth endoplasmic reticulum inside skeletal muscle, and we call that sarcoplasmic reticulum. So what does that term sarco mean to you? Skeletal muscle, right? Different parts of a skeletal muscle. So don't forget, another characteristic of skeletal muscle is that it is multinucleated, and this repeating unit over and over again is what we call striations. Okay, and that's just because of the way that actin and myosin line up within the basic functional and structural unit of contraction inside a skeletal muscle cell. So here we see what? Striations. And this is just due to the repeating pattern of actin and myosin filaments inside of a skeletal muscle fiber. All right, so there are some similarities between nervous tissue and muscle tissue, and that is both can conduct action potentials over the plasma membrane. So what kind of membrane component is necessary for an action potential? You need what, ligand-gated channels or voltage-gated channels for an action potential? Okay, you need voltage-gated channels. You need voltage-gated sodium and voltage-gated potassium channels. And so a muscle can conduct action potentials over its surface because it has those voltage-gated channels. An action potential can propagate over the surface of a muscle. But that's not the real function of a muscle. What's the real function of a muscle? Not to transmit electrical impulses or action potentials, but to contract. So an action potential is going to cause this skeletal muscle fiber to contract. So that's what muscle cells use action potentials for. Okay. And to start an action potential, there has to be a synapse between the nerve fiber and the muscle fiber. We call that synapse the neuromuscular junction. And this nerve fiber is a cholinergic fiber, which means what? What kind of neurotransmitter does it release if it's cholinergic? Acetylcholine. So there are ligand-gated channels underneath this axon terminus, okay, and the ligand-gated channels are sensitive to acetylcholine that cause massive depolarizations of the membrane on the muscle cell that always cause an action potential right away. Okay, so here is, so the neuromuscular junction is just like a regular synapse that we're aware of when an action potential comes down that releases acetylcholine. Acetylcholine moves across the synaptic cleft, binds to receptors, which causes action potentials in the muscle cell. That action potential flows over the whole sarcolemma, causing the muscle to contract. So we have synaptic vesicles, we've got mitochondria. And instead of a synaptic cleft, we call this the neuromuscular cleft, very similar. And this right here is what we call the motor end plate, and this is a little bit different than the synapse because there are many, many, many nicotinic receptors in the neuromuscular junction so that when any acetylcholine is released, right, that is always going to cause, that's always going to reach a threshold stimulus in the muscle causing an action potential. The only other big difference in the neuromuscular junction has to do with motion, right? If it's a neuron-neuron connection and an electrical signal goes from one neuron to the postsynaptic neuron, does the postsynaptic neuron move at all? Does it hop around? No, it just transmits information from one neuron to another. But what happens when this muscle gets stimulated? What's going to happen? the muscle is going to contract, right? So the neuromuscular junction is jumping around all the time. And so there has to be physical connections between the axon terminus and the muscle, because if it loses track of where it should be stimulating the muscle, then you lose control of that muscle. All right, so that's why we see this deeper invagination into the muscle right here from this axon terminus. So that's really the only major difference. And there are connections between the motor end plate and the synaptic ending right here to make sure that the neuron and the muscle don't ever pull apart from each other, because the muscle is going to be moving around. Okay, so the only place where this motor neuron can stimulate this muscle to contract is right at this motor end plate. So we can't move this axon terminus off of the motor end plate because there are no receptors out over here whatsoever. All right, the concept of a motor unit. A muscle organ is composed of millions of muscle fibers. All right, individual muscle fibers. And a motor unit is a concept where there is one motor neuron coming down, and it's going to innervate a number of muscle fibers. So in this particular case, how many muscle fibers are going to contract when there's an action potential on this somatic motor neuron? I see 3, 6, all right, and then another 4 over here. So 10 individual muscle fibers will contract. And according to this diagram, only on this side of the muscle. But these over here will remain, what, relaxed. So a motor unit is defined as one single motor neuron. Somatic and voluntary mean the same thing. So this is a voluntary motor neuron. It's going to cause the contraction of 3 muscle fibers. That's functioning as one motor unit. These 10 muscle fibers right here can never make up their own mind whether they're going to contract or not when there's an action potential on this motor neuron. It just automatically, blindly has to follow the instructions. Right? But these over here are going to stay relaxed. So here we have a little bit different motor unit. We see one motor neuron, and how many different fibers are stimulated by this motor neuron down here on the bottom of the slide? There are only 3. Right? So this is a much smaller motor unit compared to the one up on the top figure. And different parts of the body have different size motor units depending on what their function is. So for instance, if it is a postural muscle, like muscles in your back, erector spinae, the motor units are large because you don't have a lot of dexterity. You don't do a lot of different things with your back, right? You don't speak, you don't eat, you don't breathe, you don't write things, you don't communicate with your back. But for instance, what parts of your body do you want to have very fine control over? Like your fingers, your mouth, right, for communication, for writing, communication skills, manipulating tools, then motor units should be very small so that you have very fine discrimination and control over that part of your body. So don't forget, a motor unit is a single motor neuron and the individual muscle fibers that it stimulates. So here is one motor neuron and 3 muscle fibers. This one up over here is one motor neuron and 10 different muscle fibers. So motor unit number 1 is going to cause a much greater, stronger contraction compared to stimulation of motor unit number 2 down on this part of the figure. All right, so when a motor neuron is activated, all muscle fibers in that motor unit contract. The number of muscle fibers in a motor unit varies according to the degree of fine control or discrimination in that muscle. The innervation ratio is the number of motor neurons to muscle fibers, and it can vary from 1 to 100 to 1 to over 2,000, depending on what kind of motor unit it is. So fine control occurs when motor unit, the innervation ratio is small. Right? So one motor neuron innervates just a small number of fibers. Right? So how do we talk about and the contraction of a muscle? Just like an action potential is an all or none response. A muscle fiber is going to contract with whatever force it can generate. All right, but you know that, for instance, if it's a biceps muscle, we can contract it weakly, Or we can contract it very strongly. For instance, if we're just lifting up a pencil, then I want to contract the biceps very weakly so that I don't poke myself in the eye with the pencil or have it fly out of my hand. But if I'm lifting up like a gallon of milk or something that's a lot heavier, I need to contract that muscle with a lot more tension. So how can we vary the tension within a muscle like the biceps if every time you stimulate a muscle fiber, it contracts to 100% of its ability? How could you explain that? And that is because in every muscle, there are numerous motor units, right? So if you want just a weak contraction from this muscle, well, you might just stimulate this one motor neuron that's going to contract 10 muscle fibers. But if you want a contraction that is twice as strong, right, then we can stimulate two motor units. So now 20 fibers are going to contract. Or if you need to generate three times, then we need to stimulate three or four motor units, which is going to cause a stronger contraction. So by grading the force of contraction, what we do is recruit different motor units. The more motor units that are recruited, the stronger the contraction in that particular muscle. So the brain estimates the number of motor units required and stimulates them to contract, and it keeps recruiting more units until the desired movement is accomplished in a smooth fashion. More and larger motor units are activated to produce greater strength. And your brain can even deactivate motor units. And that probably has happened to you in combination with the cerebellum, for instance. Maybe you were at a restaurant someplace and everybody ordered some water and it came in those big glass tumblers, right? Or maybe you're sharing a pitcher of beer someplace and it came in those big glass tumblers. And you go, oh, okay. So you see this big, heavy glass thing filled with fluid, and you lift it up thinking it was real heavy, but it turns out it was just made out of plastic. Okay? And so what happened? So did you lose control and let it fly out of your hand? No, you lifted it up real fast, and then all of a sudden, you realize, oh, it's really light, and what happens? You relax some of the motor units that are contracting before you spill it. Okay? So that kind of just illustrates how the brain estimates, and just by visual cues, you might get it wrong, but your body picks up on what's happening very quickly. All right, so here's a muscle fiber, and you can see striations, right, that stripe pattern. And a muscle fiber, don't forget, is a muscle cell. It's multinucleate because at one time it was what? Hundreds of different muscle cells that fused together during development to make this fiber. And here you can see the organelles of contraction inside a fiber. What do we call these organelles again? These are myofibrils. And inside myofibrils, we have myofilaments. What are these myofilaments again? They're thick and thin ones. The thick ones are myosin. The thin ones are actin. And this repeating units, here we see a thick filament right here, and in this region right here, I don't see any thick filaments, so it looks a little bit lighter when we look at it. And then there's another thick filament right here, so it gets darker and then lighter because there's no myosin. It gets darker again because there's myosin, no myosin, myosin. So all of the different myofibrils line up so that these dark bands line up with each myofibril, and of course the light bands line up as well. So that gives skeletal muscle its striated appearance. Okay, the A-band. So here is, if we look at the electron micrograph of skeletal muscle, here we can see a light band and then a dark band. The light band has only actin in it. The dark band has myosin, and in sometimes it overlaps with the actin molecule. So these are things that you have to be able to label. This is an exam figure. Okay, and somebody told me that I need to add figure 12.8, okay, into your, onto Blackboard, and I'll do that. If I don't do it by Friday, somebody's got to send me an email to remind me. All right, so here is the dark band from here to here. And the light band starts from here to here. But probably even more importantly, there is another span of this tissue we have to be aware of, All right, the Z line or Z disc, there's one here and there's one here. And attached to the Z line are the actin molecules. These are proteins. So can you see actin binding here, actin binding here? So we call these Z disks or Z lines because they demarcate the end of that unit of contraction inside the myofibril. And that structural and functional unit of contraction is what we call a sarcomere. So a sarcomere extends from one Z line to the other. So what we're going to pay attention to are not so much all of the different kinds of arrangements of fascicles and connective tissue sheaths, but we really want to understand what's happening inside the sarcomere, because if we know what's happening inside the sarcomere, we pretty much know how the whole muscle contracts. Okay, so actin attaches to the end points of a sarcomere. And on the inside, we've got the thick filaments, which is myosin, and the myosin are all aligned right on this M line, right smack in the middle. Okay, so how are you going to remember this is the dark band, the A band right here, as opposed to the light band, I band. How do you know this is A and this is I? Okay, because there's an A in dark and there's an I in light, so it's really easy to remember. That's not how it was named originally, but that works for the test. All right, so these dark bands right here are what? A. And these light bands are the I bands. But we're going to have to, if you want to know why they're named, see me after class. But we're going to use the terminology for A and I bands to know something about how a muscle contracts. Okay. Furthermore, this H zone right here is a little bit of a light area. It's kind of in between light and dark, because it has myosin, which is a thick filament, but it doesn't have any actin, at least in resting muscle. Okay. All right, so here is just a different arrangement of this sarcomere. Okay, you can see the H band and the A, which stands for dark. Okay, the sarcomere in kind of a three-dimensional shape. Right, and now if we look down from the end of this myofibril, it looks like this over here. So what does this dot represent? It's going to be myosin because it's thick, right? And then what does this little dot here represent? Can you see you from the side? You probably can't see that little dot. All right, so we're looking at, so we've taken a slice of this myofibril right at about this region right here. So as I move my cursor over, what do you see? Actin, then actin, myosin, actin, on and on and on. But don't forget, this is what? Really a cylinder, so it's a three-dimensional object. So if we look at it from the end on that slice, we see a myosin, and what is surrounding every myosin? Actin molecules. And surrounding every actin molecule, you see myosin, so they're all surrounding each other. So there's going to be an association between actin and myosin that allows the sarcomere to contract. So you should be aware of this figure. I think this is the one I put in Blackboard, but this is the one that you really should be familiar with. This is easier actually to see. All right, so here is the Z line, which attaches actin. Here is myosin, interdigitated between the actin molecules, and it's held in position on the M line. There are proteins that hold it just in position, along with some other proteins that we call titin. Right, so that just holds the myosin in place. Titin is important, not because it can pull the Z lines together when the muscle is stimulated, but titin is important because one important function of muscle is the following. Okay, so I have a biceps right here. And when I contract the biceps, that causes flexion of the forearm. There's another muscle that has to do something. When I contract the biceps to flex the forearm, what's another muscle that has to do something? The triceps in the opposite body compartment. What happens to the triceps? What does it have to do? It's got to relax, right? It's got to pull apart. And if you want to say extension, that's fine with me, but it's got to pull apart a little bit. And what this Titan does is that when the biceps relaxes, the Titan pulls the triceps back to its original location. So it produces elasticity in the muscle. So the muscle will go back to its original length after the antagonistic muscle contracts. So Titan doesn't really cause contraction, it just brings the muscle back to its normal length, right, when an antagonistic muscle relaxes. Okay, so we got the H zone, A band, and the Z discs over here. All right, so how does a muscle fiber contract? All right, muscles contract because myofibrils get shorter. What the heck is a myofibril again? That is, yeah, that's this structure right here, right? So every muscle fiber is going to have many of these myofibrils. So a myofibril is the organelle. It's going to contract. And the myofibril is made up of actin and myosin. So I could ask you a question. Which one of these muscle proteins shortens when the muscle shortens? Is it myosin or is it actin? Actin? Who says actin? Okay, who says myosin? Well, not many people are gambling today. Okay. All right, well, let's take a look and see which one actually shortens when the myofibril shortens. And what really shortens is the sarcomere, right? The distance between these Z lines. That shortens. All right, so how does a fiber contract? All right, because these myofibril, and don't forget, a myofibril is just what sarcomeres lined up from one end to the other through the whole length of the muscle fiber. And this occurs because the thin filaments slide over and between the thick filaments towards the center, and thus shortening the distance from Z-disc to Z-disc. So let's see what we have right here. All right, so here we have a muscle at rest. It's its resting length. All right, so you can see the distance between these Z lines is relatively long. And here is the A band length right here. Okay. And as the muscle gets shorter, it means that the distance between these Z discs gets smaller. And that happens thousands of times over from one end of the muscle fiber to the other. All right, and that's going to shorten the overall muscle. Now let's look at this H zone. That's the zone between the actin molecules. So when the sarcomere shortens, what happens to this H zone? Is it getting bigger? It's getting smaller. It's disappearing. So that's something that we can see underneath the light microscope pretty easily. All right, so here is the H, smaller H, and here it almost has disappeared altogether. That is the H zone. Okay, well now let's pay attention to the A band. And what's the A band? It's just this length of the myosin protein. So some people said, well, the myosin actually shortens as the sarcomere shortens. Well, let's look. What's the length of this myosin molecule compared to this one right here? And compared to this one right here? You know what? It looks like it's the same length. And I wish I could actually put a ruler up there and prove it to you. But in your book, you can. Okay, measure it. Notice that the myosin doesn't contract at all. It stays the same length. So don't say that on a test. So now let's look at the actin molecule. What is an actin? So here is the length of an actin molecule. Now let's measure this length compared to this length here. And even where you're sitting, you can see it's what? Nope, it's the same length. And now let's look at the length of this actin right here. It is the same length as this one right here. So actin doesn't shorten either. So neither actin nor myosin shorten when a muscle contracts. So how do we explain that these Z lines actually come closer together? And that can be explained by the disappearance of this H zone, but there's something else that disappears within the sarcomere. And notice what band is this right here? This is the I band. Look what happens to the I band. It disappears as well. So what really happens when the Z lines come together All right, so if we have these two markers right here, one is this yellow could be actin, and this black one here could be myosin. They interdigitate when the muscle is at rest, and when the muscle contracts, right, what happens is that the actin and myosin slide over each other. So at rest, from end to end, okay, these two markers have a very long length. But as they slide over and look from end to end, are they coming? The ends of these markers coming closer together? Absolutely, right? So the sarcomere actually shortens just because actin and myosin slide over each other, and we call that the sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. So if I ask you what muscle contracts, you're going to say, well, that's a really nasty trick question, because why? There isn't a protein that actually shortens in the sarcomere. The proteins just do what? Slide over each other. We call that the sliding filament mechanism. All right, well, we got to know, since this is physiology, we got to know something about how it is that they can slide over each other. And especially when they slide over each other, it's going to generate force so that a muscle can pull with a high degree of tension. Okay, so we call this the sliding filament theory of contraction. And what the heck is a theory? What does that theory mean? Does that just mean somebody's guess? There's a lot. A theory just means that it's backed up by a lot of scientific evidence that has been repeated and reproduced by various groups throughout the world, and it is generally accepted, right? No one has ever found evidence to the contrary. Okay. So let's just see what we can say about this. Let me show you some pictures first. All right, so here we have a thick filament, and here we have a thin filament. The thick one is called myosin, and this one is called actin. All right. Notice on the myosin, it's not a smooth surface, but it has like these little arms or burrs sticking off of it. Okay, so this is what we call here's a myosin tail, and here's a myosin head group right here. And it can form cross bridges. It can actually reach up and grab an actin molecule and associate with it under certain circumstances. Right, so it has these cross bridges. The head group has a binding site for ATP. What's ATP good for? It's an energy molecule. An actin head group also has another binding site for actin. This binding site at the moment is not attached to actin. Notice that there's a space between it. Okay, and on this picture, I can't really see the binding sites on actin, okay, because they're covered up. So let's look at this actin molecule. These little globular molecules, these are what we call G-actins, and we put them together, it forms a string, and then we wrap two of these strings together that helps form an actin. But there are some other proteins on the surface of this actin molecule. There's this big, long one right here we call tropomyosin, and here's a small one we call troponin. And troponin is a cousin molecule to calmodulin. What's calmodulin noteworthy for? How have you bumped into calmodulin before? Calmodulin. Okay, calmodulin is important because it can bind calcium, and it can act as a signaling molecule. So calmodulin and troponin are very similar. All right, do you see any calcium up over here? I don't see any calcium on this diagram. All right, when there's no calcium inside the cell, the tropomyosin is covering up the binding sites that are necessary to allow the binding site on the myosin head group to bind to myosin. So in the absence of calcium inside a muscle cell, the filaments can't slide past each other. So that's the first part I want you to see with this diagram right here. Okay, the second part that I want you to see on this diagram is that the myosin has enzymatic activity. It can break down ATP. And what is in ATP? Energy, right? And when ATP is catabolized or broken down, it can release energy. And so what happens to ATP when it's broken down? It gets converted to ADP and inorganic phosphate, and the leftover thing is energy. That energy can be used, right, to straighten out this myosin group right here. Notice that this is just a straight arrangement. This one is already articulated. So this head group on a myosin can do what? It can ratchet back and forth, like your finger. It can like flex and then extend, flex and extend. Right? And the extension part of it is what the energy in ATP is used for. Okay, let's go on to the next slide. All right, so myosin can't bind actin unless it's cocked by ATP. After binding, myosin undergoes a conformation change, which we call the power stroke, which exerts force on actin. Okay, so here we see that myosin head group that has hydrolyzed ATP and has straightened out. Now, under the proper conditions, it can bind to actin. And when ADP and inorganic phosphate, or when inorganic phosphate leaves the head group, that's when the head group can flex. All right, not when ATP binds or when it's hydrolyzed, but when the inorganic phosphate is released, that causes the flexion of this head group. All right, and that causes the myosin and actin to slide over each other. All right, so like for instance, if I had my finger right here, so my finger would be, for instance, the myosin group, and this yellow piece of paper is the actin. What happens when my finger flexes? What happens to the actin? Oops. It's going to what? It's going to move. Right? It's going to slide over. Too much. It's going to slide over the myosin back and forth. Okay, that's what we call the power stroke. So here is the whole cycle of activity for what we call the sliding filament model. So at rest, right, here is a myosin, here is actin, and ATP has already been hydrolyzed, so the cross bridge is nice and straight. And step two, when inorganic phosphate is released, that causes the flexing of that head group. Right, PI is released, causing conformation change in the myosin down to this location right over here. We call that the power stroke. And then ADP is released, ATP can bind, right? And when ATP binds, then it's going to hydrolyze, right? And the head group is going to straighten out again. It's going to bind to actin, and this cycle is just going to repeat itself over and over and over again, causing actin and myosin to slide over each other. And that's going to bring the Z lines together. Okay, so ATP is necessary for sliding of these myofilaments. Now, why is it that doesn't happen all the time? Because muscle cells have ATP. So let's look at control of contraction, the control of cross bridges. Okay, the control of cross bridges attachment to actin is via the troponin-tropomyosin system. So we took a little quick look at this. Here is the G-actin molecules, and here is tropomyosin, the long molecule, and here is the troponin complex. The troponin, or tropomyosin, is in a groove between these G-actins, right? And troponin is a complex. It's attached to tropomyosin at intervals, right? It's not continuously covering the tropomyosin, but it is associated with it. And what's that molecule that's associated to troponin? It is calmodulin. So calcium is going to affect what happens with this particular system right here. In relaxed muscle, the tropomyosin, right, blocks binding sites on the G-actin molecules. Right, so when the active sites are blocked, the myosin head group can't bind to actin, and the filaments can't slide over each other. right? But when calcium binds to troponin, calcium is going to cause a conformation change in troponin and the tropomyosin complex, and is going to move the tropomyosin out of the way, revealing binding sites. All right, so for instance, here we have a binding site. This binding site is going to match up with the actin binding site on the myosin head group. But in this particular condition, we don't have any calcium floating around inside the myofibril. And so there's no calcium bound to the troponin. That means that the tropomyosin is covering up the binding sites. But when calcium concentration increases, like we see down in the second part of this slide right here, calcium binds to troponin, and look what happens to tropomyosin. It moves from over the binding sites to above the binding sites, so now the myosin head group can bind to actin, and cross-bridge cycling can occur as long as there is ATP, and the filaments can slide over each other. Okay, so troponin, the signal for sliding of the filaments is this calcium signal inside the myofibrils. But of course, don't forget you need ATP in order for things to cycle. All right, so we want to look at and see, where does this calcium come from? Where does this calcium signal come from? All right, so we said that a muscle cell acts like a nerve axon in a lot of respects because it can transmit action potentials, because there are voltage gate and sodium channels, right, and then potassium channels for allowing for repolarization. So an action potential can flow over the whole sarcolemma, which is the plasma membrane of a muscle fiber cell. And furthermore, that electrical signal, unlike nerve fibers, can be transmitted deep within the muscle fiber or muscle cell via these, what we call transverse tubules or T-tubules. So transverse tubules and T-tubules have voltage-gated channels as well. And that action potential gets into this T-tubule from, what, this little orifice right here on the surface all over the place on a muscle cell. And when, so what else do we have in this cell? What the heck do, what are these little things? These are organelles. What are these organelles called? These are the myofibrils, right, made up of sarcomeres, actin, and myosin filaments. Okay. So this is now inside the cell, and don't forget every cell is multinucleated. What else do we see on the cell? This network right here. Okay, probably is the same color as this thing. This is what we call the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And I mentioned what the sarcoplasmic reticulum is. We see it in muscle cells. Can you relate sarcoplasmic reticulum to organelles in a regular cell? What do we call it in a regular cell? We just call it smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So endoplasmic reticulum is really just a smooth endoplasmic reticulum in other cells, but in muscles, it's not responsible primarily for lipid synthesis. In skeletal muscle, it's a reservoir for calcium. So there are calcium pumps that are always pumping calcium from the cytoplasm of the muscle cell back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And this area right here is what we call a triad. It's composed of a transverse tubule and these two terminal cisternae of a sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when an action potential goes through the transverse tubule, it opens up calcium channels. And calcium is going to diffuse from high concentration to low. Where is high concentration? Inside the endoplasmic reticulum or sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it's going to flood, right, all over the myofibril because that's where the low concentration is. And when it enters the myofibril, what's going to happen? Let's go back. Calcium is going to bind to troponin. That's going to cause a conformation change in tropomyosin, and that's going to allow actin and myosin to form a crossbridge, which is going to cause the actin and myosin filaments to slide over each other. So that process is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. Okay, so how does it get excited? Because an action potential flows over the cell membrane, down into a T-tubule, causing release of calcium. That calcium gets attaches to troponin and moves tropomyosin out of the way, and the actin and myosin filaments can start to slide over each other. Okay, so even a better look of this is this diagram right here. So here we have a neuromuscular junction. Here is the motor end plate. So here is a motor fiber. So what kind of neurotransmitter is being used right here? What kind of neurotransmitter is in this synaptic vesicle? That's acetylcholine, right? And on skeletal muscle, it's always going to have a nicotinic type acetylcholine receptor, right? Which is just what kind of membrane protein is a nicotinic receptor? Is it a G protein? Does it change metabolism? Or is it an ion channel or what? It's an ion channel, right? So a nicotinic receptor is just a simple ion channel. When acetylcholine binds to it, that opens up a sodium channel. Sodium enters the cell. And how does that affect the electrical activity of the muscle cell? That depolarizes it, right? So that's an excitatory stimulus to the muscle. And there are thousands of voltage-gated channels, even under the neuromuscular junction, so that when this cell depolarizes, it always sets up an action potential on the cell membrane, and that action potential is propagated over the whole cell surface as well as down into the T-tubules right here. That action potential moves deep inside of the cell. Okay, and when it does so, okay, that action potential then is going to cause the opening of calcium channels in the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and calcium is going to leave the SR and bind to troponin, and that's going to cause the sliding of the actin and myosin filaments past each other. Okay. Now, in this system right here, we have a couple of different kinds of receptors. Right, we have voltage-gated channels that propagate the action potential, but the receptor between the transverse tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum is very interesting. It's a ryanodine receptor. So that just means, so what's happening to this voltage-gated channel when threshold voltage is reached? Okay, what happens to that sodium channel when the threshold voltage is reached? It changes conformation, right? It actually moves. It opens up and allows sodium to go through that particular channel. But the most important thing is what? That there is a motion in that protein. Like, in order for you to walk into this room, what do you have to do to that door? You got to open it up, right? It's got to swing, which is just a physical motion. And have you ever, for instance, we're on one side of the door and you wanted to get through that doorway and you pushed it open, but unfortunately somebody was standing in front of the door on the other side and you couldn't see him, what would happen? Well, they get bonked in the head or the nose or something, right? So the physical motion of that door can have an effect on whatever on the other side of the doorway, right? Because that doorway is swinging. So when the sodium-gated channel changes conformation, it is going to pull on what we call a ryanodine receptor on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So there is a mechanical coupling, right, between the voltage-gated channels in the transverse tubule and the calcium channels on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. We call that the electromechanical release. And that's really the only kind of mechanical receptor that we're going to talk about in this class, and we call that the ryanodine receptor. So as soon as this voltage-gated sodium channel changes shape, that pulls on the ryanodine receptor, which opens up a calcium channel. All right, so action potentials in the transverse tubules cause release of calcium from the terminal cisternae via voltage-gated channels and calcium release channels, and that's due to that ryanodine receptor. We call that electromechanical release. So that ryanodine receptor is not sensitive to the voltage, it's just sensitive to what? The physical change in that voltage-gated channel, because it has to change shape. Okay, so here is just a flow diagram of excitation-contraction coupling. A somatic motor neuron is stimulated. That means an action potential comes down the axon to the axon terminus that causes release of acetylcholine. Now, what can you remember what ion inside the axon terminus is necessary to cause the docking and fusing of the synaptic vesicles at the axon terminus to release neurotransmitter? It's calcium. It's that calcium signal, right, in the neuron. So calcium is important for synaptic transmission, but also for transmission across the neuromuscular junction. And when acetylcholine is released, that binds to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, which opens, that's just a ligand-gated channel for sodium. So sodium diffuses in, depolarizes the muscle, and that always, always, always produces an action potential. All right, so that stimulus always produces an action potential, which is not always so with what a neuron, right? Because the graded potentials in a neuron sometimes are sub-threshold. But at the neuromuscular junction, they're always threshold potentials. So that action potential then gets conducted along the whole surface of the cell and including the transverse tubules, so the action potential goes down deep inside the myofibrils. And those action potentials then open voltage-gated calcium channels, right? We call that the ryanodine receptor, which then causes more channels, calcium channels, to open up in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And these are what we call the DHP receptors. And these DHP receptors are 10 times the size of the ryanodine receptors in terms of diameter. So when they open up, what happens to calcium? Even more calcium can leave the sarcoplasmic reticulum because the DHP receptors are huge in diameter. And then that calcium binds to troponin, stimulating contraction or the sliding of the filaments over each other within the myofibril. So this scheme right here is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. And in lab, you looked at the effects of this. You stimulated a nerve, which was connected to a muscle, and you could measure the electrical activity as well as the force generated by the muscle. And what you noticed was, right, so if this is time, right over here, and if this is an action potential or the electrical stimulus, so here is voltage of a muscle fiber, and then you could measure tension. You did this in a computer simulation. Okay, when did the muscle start to contract? Not exactly when there was an action potential, but when? All right, a little bit after it was stimulated. It would produce a twitch. So here is the peak of the action potential. Here is the peak of the twitch. And what did we call this point in time? That's what we call the latent period. And now you can kind of explain that latent period. Because what has to happen? So here is stimulation of the nerve. What has to happen before the muscle actually contracts? Well, you need to open sodium channels to cause an action potential on the muscle cell. That action potential has to flow over the whole muscle cell, and then it's got to open up calcium channels. All right, and then the calcium has to diffuse throughout the whole myofibril, and it's got to bind to a troponin, moving tropomyosin out of the way, and then after all of that, the actin and myosin can start to slide over each other. So that's why there is a time delay between stimulation of a muscle and when it begins to contract, because there are a number of things that have to happen, including things like diffusion of calcium through the myofibril, and that's that period of time we call the latent period. I don't know if that was on any of your quizzes in lab or not. Okay, what about muscle relaxation? After it contracts, you would like for it to go back to its relaxed state. All right, and that's really due because, calcium from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum diffuses to troponin to initiate cross-bridge cycling and contraction. All right, but we want to stop that process. All right, that happens when action potentials cease, the muscle relaxes because the calcium channels close and calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So surrounding every myofibril is that sarcoplasmic reticulum. So here's sarcoplasmic reticulum. And here we have actin and myosin. Here we have calcium. Right? When action potentials no longer are coming down the transverse tubule, there are proteins in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum that pump calcium back in. So when we say a pump, what kind of protein is a pump? Tell me something about a pump. We talked about pumps before. There are a couple of important considerations. A pump can move things from what? High to low or low to high? You know what? A pump can move things from low concentration to high. So even though there's a high concentration inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum, calcium can still move in. What kind of process is that? Is that passive or active? That's active. Going from high to low is passive, but from low to high requires energy. What's the form of energy? ATP. So this pump right here, this is really what? Calcium ATP pump. So in order for muscles to relax, okay, it requires ATP from this standpoint as well, so that calcium can leave the myofibril and go back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So this protein is also taking ATP and making what? ADP plus inorganic phosphate as a result. And when calcium concentration decreases inside the myofibril, then the actin and myosin can't slide past each other because there's no calcium binding to that troponin molecule. And if there's no calcium bound to troponin, maybe we'll have to go back. If there's no calcium bound to troponin, right? So when calcium gets pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, look what happens. It goes back to this state right here. Tropomyosin then covers up the binding sites, and so the myosin head group can't bind to actin, and the filaments can't slide past each other. Okay, so that's what we call excitation-contraction coupling. All right, so you got to look at that over the weekend. Now, let me just preview a couple of these slides right here to see what I got to talk about on Monday. Okay, not too much. We're going to talk about some smooth muscle. Yeah, we got to talk about smooth muscle. All right, let me just say one thing. In terms of what is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells called? The structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Okay, structural and functional unit. I think I wrote this on the board. Structural and functional unit of communication. Between cells, we got to know something about that before we leave, and the structural and functional unit of contraction. Structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle. And then there's one I'm not going to write on the board because you know this. What's the structural and functional unit of life? The cell. Okay? And so if you know how a cell functions, you know a lot about life. All right? So If you know what this thing is, you know how cells communicate with each other. What's that structural and functional unit of communication between cells called? And that's called a... Somebody say it out loud. Synapse. Okay, so we look at the neuromuscular junction. That's a synapse. And don't forget, there are two kinds of synapses. I hope I mentioned this to you. I hope I did. Maybe I did. Maybe it was an anatomy class. There is a chemical kind of synapse, and there is electrical kind of synapse. All right, so a chemical synapse uses a chemical to carry information between cells. What do we call that chemical, generally speaking? Okay, yeah, it acts as a ligand because it's got to bind to a receptor. But that's not really the word I'm looking for. The word I'm looking for is neurotransmitter. Okay, it's a neurotransmitter is a signaling molecule released by one neuron, diffuses across the synapse, binds to a receptor on the postsynaptic cell, causing what, either EPSP or IPSPs on that postsynaptic neuron. The second kind of synapse is an electrical synapse. Right? And an electrical synapse just allows for sodium currents to go from one cell directly into the neighboring cell. So if one cell in a tissue depolarizes, that electrical signal can flow from one to the other, to the other, to the other. That's an electrical synapse. And we have an example of an electrical synapse, not in skeletal muscle, all right, but in cardiac muscle. So this is characteristic of cardiac muscle. Remember back to anatomy. It is striated, but it is also what? Branched. This can't be skeletal muscle because it's branched. So this is cardiac muscle. And here are the gap junctions between cells. So cardiac muscles are not long and narrow. They're short and branched. So here is the end of one cell and the beginning of the next cell. So when this cell depolarizes, that sodium current can go right through the gap junction. And what happens when sodium enters this neighboring cell? What happens to it electrically? It depolarizes, and that it produces what? That's excitatory. That depolarizations are excitatory, and that depolarization can go through this whole cell and do what? Move down over here, stimulate this cell, right? So that depolarization can flow from one end of the heart to the other, but it can also flow from one layer in the heart to a deeper layer, and a deeper layer because heart cells are branched. So you only need depolarization in one cell in the heart to cause the whole heart to depolarize. Because this is, what kind of synapse is this? This is not a chemical synapse, doesn't use neurotransmitters. It just allows for direct electrical connection between the cells. Okay, so this is an example of how cardiac muscle works. And that's great for cardiac muscle because you want your whole heart to contract when it's pumping. But for instance, would we like electrical synapses or gap junctions between all the muscles, for instance, in your biceps? No, because if one muscle fiber in the biceps contracted, what would happen? They all would contract, and you'd be black and blue all the time because you'd just be punching yourself. You couldn't grade contraction. Okay, now, what is this last thing? This is what we talked about today. The structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle is the... Well, neuromuscular junction is a synapse, and it, what kind is it? Is it chemical or electrical? It's chemical because it uses what? Acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter. Okay, but the functional and structural unit of contraction is the sarcomere. So if you know how that sarcomere functions, you really pretty much know how everything contracts in a skeletal muscle. Sarcomere. So that's the structural and functional unit in skeletal muscle, is that sarcomere. So you got to know the anatomy of a sarcomere, but it's kind of a review from anatomy, because in anatomy you had to know the thin and thick filaments and the dark band and the light band and what they're called and all that kind of stuff. So what's new in this class is what? Excitation-contraction coupling, how the action potential flows over the cell. Okay, see you.